Okay, it's 8 o'clock. Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club. We're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts of bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight's speaker is Lisa M.K. She wasn't on the schedule, but I had to reschedule the speaker that was going to be here, and Lisa's the kind of person that dropped everything and accepted the invitation to bail me out again. And she's told her story here before. She's from the Buford area. She goes to a lot of meetings. She'll tell you what her home group is. But the last time she spoke, I said, do y'all have, you know, anybody that might be, you know, as good as you as sharing the message of sobriety and, you know, and doing the deal? And she, I think there were like 7 or 8, maybe 10 speakers over the next 6 months. And we saw a lot of Lisa back then, because every time she had somebody come, she came to support them. So anyway, I hope this is the start of another trend. Welcome, Lisa. She's got a great story.
Thank you, Tim. Oh, I can put that there. All right. I have cough drops in case I cough because allergies. My name's Lisa. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. So I will start off letting you guys know that I have a sobriety date of April 8th of 2012. My home group is first things first. What is my home group? I don't know. First things first in Buford. That's at Serenity House. I have a sponsor. She has a sponsor. And I also sponsor women. It's one of the highlights of my life today. And to tell you about what it was like growing up, Lisa. I grew up with a mom that drank a lot. So to me, that was just really how you drank. You know, I looked at that. I didn't like it very much. But for me, that was just what drinking was. You know, drinking looked like throwing up after you drank, yelling bad words after you drank, causing chaos in your home after you drank. That's what it looked like. And my dad was the fixer. So he would go behind her and try to clean up the messes and, you know, oh, maybe, you know, it makes you question as a kid, maybe it wasn't that bad because, you know, my dad's still smiling and he's trying to make it like everything's okay for me and my sister. And it was just a pattern. It was just consistent. Back in the day, a lot of you remember the corded phones. My mom would bring the corded phone into my room, and that was old school drinking and dialing. So she would bring the phone into my room and drunk dial people and complain about my dad. And that was me as a young girl. That's what I got to hear a majority of my adolescence, which I didn't really want to hear. You know, as a kid, you don't want to hear stuff like that. That's kind of, it's annoying. It smells. You don't want to be around a person like that. And plus, she smoked. And I hated smoking. And, you know, all this, it just was a lot. It's a lot as a kid. But then I also, I'm an extrovert. I like people a lot. So I would get out of my house, I would be at school, and I'd have a great time. I remember somebody sharing in a meeting one time that when they left their house, when they crossed from their driveway onto the pavement, they could breathe, you know. They could really take a fresh breath as they did that. And that, I had never thought about it until that moment. That's how I felt. When I wasn't at home in that chaos, I felt like I could take a breath of fresh air. And that was a godsend, you know. So I loved being out of the house. I was out of the house every opportunity I could get. I took dance, so I danced a lot, and that was like 7 days a week. And so I would do that stuff, and I had my extracurricular activities, keeping me out of trouble for the most part. And I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to smoke. I was just said I was not going to be the drunk mom. Fast forward. 13 years old, I take my first drink. Apparently, it does end up seeming pretty cool to me, and I'm pretty fascinated by this. But, you know, I don't think anybody takes their first drink thinking I'm going to be a sloppy drunk. I took it because I wanted to be fun. You know, I'm fun, I'm mature, I am, anything goes. So I take that first drink with my friend Lisa. It was Lisa. We were Lisa and Nicole Jam. And we drank our four wine coolers together. And we thought it was the greatest thing in the world. You know, we got completely wasted. I remember feeling like I was walking sideways. I don't remember half of the night. I passed out, all that good stuff. But I loved it because it changed the way that I felt. And I didn't have to think about all the crap going on in my home, you know. Because it had been going on just for so long. I didn't want to deal with it anymore. And there's my little entrance into the, oh, okay. But I'm still never going to drink like my mom. And I'm trying cigarettes at this point, too, because I'm very cool. And it's very, you know, I look very old when I smoke. So I'm doing the things that I said I'd never do. I'm drinking and I'm smoking. And so that sets the tone for me. My high school life was drinking. I went to a Catholic school. If you're a Catholic, you know that's how we roll. We drink, period. I mean, we give you wine at Mass, okay? So here's some bread, wash it down with some wine. And that's what we do. I mean, for First Communion, you have to practice drinking wine. I mean, so these are things that are just normal. Drinking is normal in my household. It's a normal thing to do. Nobody's surprised that I drink. My parents aren't blown away by the fact that I drink, and I was drinking heavily. From the get-go, I drank like an alcoholic, not necessarily because I had any idea about the phenomenon of craving, but because I wanted to. I wanted to drink all that I had, all that you had, all that everybody had. Give me all of the alcohol. There is not enough in the world for me. That's how I drank from the very beginning. I never wanted to do the 1-2. Let me be a really feminine little girl. I wanted to chug beer, burp as loud as I can, and be one of the guys. So let's do this. And I did. Very, very proud for my parents. So. I can still burp really loud, by the way. Anyway, that's a side note. It's just something you remember. Not as much, though, because I don't drink beer. So, you know, you just, or soda. So it's hard to burp like that without that. But I'm not going to drink beer again for that reason. So alcohol was my friend. It was my buddy. It was the most fun I'd ever had. And it also added to the fun time I was already having with people. During my formative years, I drank alcoholically. And that's all I knew how to do. So I didn't even know how to be me as a person to people because I was drunk most of the time. I had no idea how to talk to people sober. I didn't realize that. You know, I thought I did, but I didn't. Any party I went to, I had already drank before I got there. So my people skills are already, I don't know how to people. I don't know how to do that because I've already shut myself off from you with alcohol. I'm not really having a conversation with you. All I'm really doing is thinking about the next drink I'm going to get over there. That's how my drinking looks. I'm not really paying attention to what you have going on because you have more in your glass than I have in mine, and I want what you have. And then, of course, I'm going to get mad at you if you try to take my keys away from me if I'm driving. That's the biggest thing. So at 19 years old, that's how my drinking looked, you know, period. I could tell you a million stories. At 19 years old, I got my first DUI. And that did nothing other than my spoiled, rotten little self calling my father saying, "They took my jewelry. I can't believe they took my jewelry." I'm crying to my dad that they took my jewelry. That's the theme of my life. I accept no responsibility for my actions, and I blame everybody for the things going on in my life. So these are the cops taking my jewelry, because obviously they hate me and they don't know who I am. "You're taking my jewelry." My dad, "Oh, my poor daughter, let me come bail you out. I will do that." And we got Waffle House on the way home, and everything was great. You know, he had to pay $500, and that's it. I think it was just $500. I got a second DUI. My dad came and got me out of jail. That time I think we drove through McDonald's, so it wasn't as big of an event. And I did get talked to on the way home. Then I got DUI number three. I can't tell you the ages because I really don't remember, unless I'm sure it's somewhere in a court of law. I've got many mug shots to prove it. But so DUI number three, I get that, and my dad picks me up and takes me straight home. You know, and I obviously was not getting DUIs to try to please my dad and to, "Hey, do you love me and will you drive me to places so we can hang out?" I never had that problem. My dad was always there for me. But I noticed here, he is not happy with me. You know, I'm just getting driven straight home. Well, at that point, I was in my 20s. I had already met my husband, who, by the way, is a very normal person. And he does not drink or party like a rock star. And I said to him a few years ago, I was like, "God, you either are crazy or you really love me." Because we've been together for now like 25 years, I think. But so he married me when I had three DUIs already. And I don't even think I had my license when we got married. And here's this normal guy, you know, having to drive me everywhere. But I thought it was no problem. I took zero responsibility for the actions that I took. You know, DUIs. I could have killed people. I could have killed myself. I took zero responsibility for my actions. I thought it was fun. I thought it was funny. But after three, I stopped really telling people about it. I wasn't about to, you know, go into a group of people and say I have three DUIs. That's not anything that people want to talk about, and people might tell you that you have a problem, which people were starting to tell me. "Lisa, you might have a problem," which I don't want to hear. I don't think any alcoholic really wants to hear that. We don't like hearing that, because if you tell me that I have a problem, you're the problem. You are now the problem, and bye. I don't want you in my life any longer, because you're trying to take my favorite thing in the whole world from me. And that's how I am. I am defiant. I am belligerent. Don't take my alcohol. That's the one thing. I will fight you. Do not take my alcohol. And so I ended up getting number four, number five, number six, and at seven I finally got sober. But during that time frame, we get married. I have two children, two amazing, wonderful children, and you would think that something like that would slow you down a little bit. And it did, you know. I mean, I didn't drink like that when I was pregnant. I didn't smoke cigarettes when I was pregnant. But I couldn't wait to drink again after I gave birth. I remember telling everybody that I was still, it's still the obsession. It's still the obsession. I can't wait to get drunk after I give birth. I'm not even focusing on the fact that I'm about to have a beautiful, amazing baby with the man that I love, because I can't wait to get drunk. That's a problem. Normal people don't think like that. You know, I had a couple women that were pregnant at the same time as me, and they weren't talking like that. So We have our children. I'm still drinking like an alcoholic. Nothing is getting worse or better in my home life, except for my husband's pretty darn sick of it. He used to take things out of my car so I couldn't drive, or he would stand behind my car, and this is kind of funny, but kind of not, because I just told you how defiant we are. So he would stand behind my car so I wouldn't pull out the driveway. Well, I pulled around the backyard, out the front, and off the sidewalk. I mean, go on, dude. I'm resourceful. If I want more drinks, you're not stopping me. But I just can't believe I did stuff like that. And yelling at him profanity as I did all that, too. Really pretty. Very feminine. It's probably like, oh, there goes my little beauty queen. Bye-bye. Be careful. So he's sick of it. He is sick and tired of having a drunk wife and mother of his kids. And I remember telling him all the time, you're an old man. You don't want to party. You don't want to do anything. You're lame. You're stupid. I don't know why you don't want to hang out with me. I would say these horrible things to him all the time. And he would tell me all the time, I don't want to be hungover. I'm going running. I want to get up. We have children. I don't want to feel like that. However, normal people think like that. I couldn't relate. I just really thought he was boring and old and stupid. I thought anybody that didn't drink is stupid and that you're boring. I didn't know that there could be a life outside of alcohol that was fun or full of joy. I didn't want any part of that. So whatever he was, and I'm also like, you married me like this. You knew I liked to drink. So, every time we would go out, I'd have to get alcohol on the way home. Why do you still have to drink once we get home? It just goes back to that there isn't enough alcohol in the world for me. Period. Ever. But I got to get to that point. I have to get to that point where I'm the one saying enough is enough. I give up. Until I get to that point, I'm going to keep drinking, even if it's miserable. Even if it's miserable, and when it's miserable, I keep drinking. So that's what I do. So I have all these consequences for my actions, the DUIs. They arrest you every time that you get a DUI, and you go to jail every time you get a DUI. So I've been to jail. I've been to work release. I picked up, I did the work alternative program, 30 plus 30. So I did 60 days of that. And that is like court appointed. You're on one of those buses riding around with red or orange things on you, like a worker picking up trash on the side of the road. You're cleaning out toilets in parks. And that's when I had kids, too, and they would have, kids would be at the park, and they would push their kids away from us. Like, the moms would be scared. And I'm thinking, I'm a mom. I'm a mom. It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. That didn't stop me from drinking. These are things that I get embarrassed. We have forgetters as alcoholics. I have a forgetter. We can't recall with sufficient force a week, a month, or whatever. We just can't recall. I don't remember how bad it was, so I'm going to do it again. This time it'll be different. This time I won't ever make everybody mad. This time I'll remember things. This time when I wake up, Bob won't be yelling at me. This time, whatever, It's just I loved alcohol more than I loved myself. That's what it was. And I was riddled with alcoholism, and I had no idea. I was torn up with it. And people were telling me, at least you're an alcoholic. You need help. You're an alcoholic. I had neighbors trying to plan an intervention on me. I told them what they could do with their little intervention. My husband would say, alcohol or me. Alcohol or your family. I chose alcohol every single time. And so, it was almost right, We were getting a divorce. DUI number 7 was January 10th of 2012. I was 40 years old. And I don't think there's a single person in here that would ever say, I think my goal in life is to get 7 DUIs. I don't think I ever started off my drinking thinking that that's something that I would hit that mark. Because that's embarrassing. I don't go around telling that to people. you know. And now I use it as part of my story because it is a part of my story that can help people. Guess what? I've been there, done that, and I'm here now. And if you heard, I've been sober since 2012. That is the miracle, you know. So, and that's all God. That's not Lisa. Lisa doesn't make good decisions, by the way. So, I get that 7th DUI, January 10th of 2012, and I am in absolute hell. You know, the only kind of hell that an alcoholic has. We hit that bottom, we hit it hard. And we know that this time, the gig is up. The gig is up. But that consequence didn't do it for me. I wish I could say that that DUI stopped me drinking, because it surely didn't. It was still my husband's fault. But let me tell you about the DUI. I got to tell this in front of him last week. By the way, that was the first time ever my husband got to hear my story, and he kept telling me I lived it. And he did, and he probably remembers a lot more than I do. But so that night I was in my neighborhood at one of our neighbors drinking wine, drinking, as usual. So I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to get completely wasted. I do that. I get into my car to drive back home, four houses down. I pull in my driveway, and I hit his car. Put a little dent in it. Didn't do anything to mine, by the way. But but our daughter runs out. She sees it, runs inside, and says, "Daddy, Mom, Mommy hit your car." He comes out. He is not happy. You know, this is the man who has had enough. Enough. He's the one that called the cops, and the reason why the cops were in the neighborhood. I pulled out of the driveway like, oh, God, this is not going to be good. I don't even know where I went in my neighborhood. I know I didn't leave my neighborhood, but I don't know because I was so drunk. But the next thing you know, I pull down my street, and there are cop cars waiting on the end of the street. And I just pull up there because I can talk my way out of this because I'm just in my neighborhood. You can't get a DUI in your neighborhood. You know, not thinking that I have 6 DUIs already, and I'm sure they won't look that up, and that won't look bad. And the first thing I say when the cop asked me to get out of the car, I said to her, or she said, "You're going to need to do a field sobriety test." I said, "I can't do that. I'm too drunk." They like that. That's good for you, for them. I think I blew like a .28. I was yelling every cuss word possible at my husband from right there because he stood outside and watched. This was 7 o'clock at night. So not only was my husband out there, I had neighbors lining the street watching me yelling the F-bomb at my husband in every way that you could possibly yell that at somebody from the cul-de-sac, four houses down, and handcuffed. That's me. Exactly. If that's not unmanageable, I'm not real sure what is. But again, that moment wasn't my moment. So I kept drinking, thinking it was, you know, my husband's fault. And it's my husband's fault. I hate him, getting everybody to hate him with me. I eventually had a divine intervention. I had a burning bush moment. A lot of people don't have those. They talk about the slow variety of the spiritual experience, but mine was fast. And it happened 2 months before I got sober. What happened was I was sitting in my bed at home because I was paralyzed with fear, guilt, remorse, regret, everything. My life was in shambles. And I still didn't realize I was the one that put me in all this. So I see this train wreck, billowing smoke. And I realized for the first time in my whole entire life that that train wreck is my life and that I caused the train wreck. It was a vision. I do not know. I was not drinking when this happened. I don't know why. Go God, because that's what I needed to have my attention. You know, finally, to get my attention. Hey, Lisa, here's the deal. Here's what's going on, and you're the problem. And then, when you know you're the problem, that doesn't feel real good. After all these years of all these people saying that you're an alcoholic, you have a problem. You drink too much. And me saying, no, I drink because I want to. I just have a good time. I party. I don't know what you're talking about. Don't take away my party time. The gig was up. It truly was up, and it was horrible. It was a horrible but wonderful feeling. Because 2 months later, what happened is I got my butt up. Finally. It took me that last week of drinking, though, I don't know if you guys remember yours, but I sure do remember mine. So my life was absolutely horrible. My husband and I were getting a divorce. I had a DUI attorney and a divorce attorney at this point. And my husband took our kids to Florida for spring break. And I'm actually thinking, because I'm an alcoholic, all right, that's cool, because I get to drink however I want to drink. He's not here to bug me, look at me, watch me. I'm going to drink however I want to drink. Well, the Wednesday of that week, a friend of mine from elementary school came over with alcohol, because, of course, I asked everybody to bring me alcohol. And she told me about how her mom had died of alcoholism. It's one of the things she shared with me while we're having our good time. And it stuck out to me in that she said, I have never told anybody that my mom died of alcoholism, and she died 7 years ago. She had never told a single person. Why is she telling me that day? Talked to this guy I went to high school with, and he said, you know what? I think you should make Sunday your sobriety day, because Sunday that year was Easter Sunday. It's like a rebirth, you know? So have Sunday be your sobriety date. You can, you know, drink for the last time Saturday, and Sunday can be your date. And after that, just don't drink for a year. See how that works for you. See what happens. I'm like, all right, cool. You know, I like the fact that I could still drink for a couple more days. You know, that's always a bonus. But that's really what I was looking at, probably. But I'm like, okay, cool. So I do that. These things are happening. What ended up with that guy, his brother now has like 28 years of sobriety. So he knew what he was talking about. But that was not one of my best friends. Why did I call him? Okay? So these are God moments that are happening in my life that I don't even know are happening. There's God. There's God. And then I don't even get drunk on Saturday. I don't even know what I drank. I had like one or two drinks, and Bob and the kids came home, and it was horrible. It was horrible. My kids were scared. They didn't know what was going on. Bob hated me. I hated him, too. It was a two-way street there. And it was bad. It was absolute chaos in my home. But I want to let you guys know that the chaos was caused by me. I'm the chaos starter. The tornado roaring through the lives of others. I didn't know that. I didn't know that until that moment. So I know finally that I'm a tornado and I've caused the damage in these people's lives, and I don't know how to fix it. The next day, or 2 days later, the day after my sobriety date, a friend sat down with me and he told me, fix the woman and the world will fall into place. I thought that was one of the coolest things I'd ever heard in my entire life. Fix the woman and the world will fall into place. What? That means I could get better? I mean, I don't know how to do that. I know how to screw up. I know how to mess up. I'm familiar with that. I'm familiar with people getting mad at me because I'm messing up. I know I do all these things. Okay. Fix the woman in the world. I'm gonna believe you. So here's where I have become open-minded for the first time in my whole life that you might be right. All right, I'm going to listen to you. I'm going to listen to the suggestions that other people give me. And I hit the ground running. You know, I hit the ground running. I picked up my white chip, and on the way home from that meeting, I remember exactly where I was. And every time I pass it, it feels like holy land to me, because I yelled out at the top of my lungs, help me, God. Help me, God. And I'll tell you what, the power of sincere prayer is what does it. The power of sincere prayer. When you're the most gutted, at your absolute lowest point, help me, God. You know, I could use all these words. Help me, God. I have not had any desire to drink. I mean, red wine was my jam and it still smells good, but to me it looks like puke. It smells like puke. How does that happen? You know, it's a psychic change for me. I'm a completely different human being. God has restored me somewhat to sanity. I'm not going to claim it all because I'm not. But we're working on that. You know, he and I go hand in hand. And my first sponsor walked me through all the steps, and she did so with patience, love, and tolerance. She listened to me, and she thanked me every single time for meeting with her. And I felt like I was important enough for her to spend time with. She listened. She listened a lot, and sometimes she didn't respond when I texted her because I texted her like 19 pages. You know, when you're new, you have a lot to say. But I was very important still. But since then, I'm resigned from general manager of the universe. I know today I'm not that important. I'm not that big of a deal, although I am important. I am important, but I'm not that important. I'm not that big of a deal. I am right-sized, and that's huge. Because the whole world used to revolve around me. I remember one of the many times I've been to the courthouse, I was taking a left to go to the courthouse, and some lady coming this way was smiling, and I'm thinking, how could she be smiling when my whole world is like this? You know, this is what I'm thinking. Like somebody can't smile because I've gotten in trouble. You guys don't be happy because of me, okay? You know, it's just come and I don't think like that anymore today. Our book talks about God and others all over it. That's really what it is, God and the constant thought of others. So today I have the opportunity to work with other alcoholics. I get to do service work for Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the most amazing things I get to do for Alcoholics Anonymous is go to jail and leave. I get to bring AA meetings there. And I have a lady right here in front of me that I met in the jail who is a little success story. And I love her so much. And she's a really neat lady. If you have an opportunity to talk to her sometime, she has a lot to share. But I'll tell you what, there is nothing better than that. You get to give away what you've been given, and then you see the light come on in somebody's eyes. You see somebody live when you saw them dying. That's incredible. That's incredible. Because that was me. I know Amy saw that in me. You know, to go from, how do we get from there to here? It's all divine intervention. All I got to do is put some feet underneath these steps. I got to take action. I have to go to meetings. I have to call my sponsor. I have to work with other people. I have to do these things because if I don't do these things, it says I'm going to drink again. I believe this book and I believe the people that wrote it, and that scares me. Because for me, I have an opportunity to get DUI number 8 and kill other people this time. Okay? So, I think I'm good. I'm about tapped out, and again, there's not enough alcohol in the world for me. But one of the coolest things that I get to do today, again, is working with other alcoholics. The service work, because I have no business not giving back to this program what it's given to me. I have a life today because I'm sober. My husband and I, our family is the restored family it talks about in the big book. One day he looked at me and he said, why now? You know, he like, after all these years, why now? That's all he said. I said, I don't know. But you know what? I do know now. God's timing. God's timing. It's not mine. Maybe I wouldn't have heard it before. I didn't hear it before, apparently. It's right on time. It's exactly when it was supposed to happen. And so all of the promises have come true in my life, and they keep coming true for me. Because in Dr. Bob's Nightmare, he talks about putting as much zeal into your program as you did into your drinking. That's my jam right there. Because I don't know about you, but I put a lot of time, energy, and effort into my drinking. So if I put that much time, energy, and effort into my sobriety, what do you think I'm going to get from that? I'm going to get a good... I'm going to be happy, joyous, and free. And I am. the life I live today, I live my life from the inside out. I am so happy. Happy, joyous, and free is like bare minimum. The freedom is what the jam is. I don't need anything to wake up. I don't need anything to go to sleep. I needed so much from that time to that time, all the time, I thought. You know, I'm not polluted any longer, and I can be present in my life, for my children, for my husband, for my parents. You know, I get to be of love and service to my mom today. I get to be of love and service to my dad, my sister. Alcoholics Anonymous mends relationships if you put into it what they give you, you know. For me, I get so much more. It's unbelievable to me what I get in return for just suiting up, showing up. That's my timer for me. Suiting up, showing up, and shutting up. That's it.
Putting on your cowboy boots, cowgirl boots.
All right.
All right. Thank you very much. That was fantastic. Tinsley, one more time.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Thanks, Lisa. That was great. I got a lot out of that. Enjoyed it very much. Here at this meeting, we offer chips to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try this way of life one day at a time, we offer a white chip. Anybody like to pick up a white chip? 30 days, we have a silver chip. Anybody got 30 days?
Blotting out blind. you.